bespeak we, bespeak you, and I will always be me. Be good, be better than me, be great, be greater than the next, but be true to what you believe. Be honest, be real, be more humble, but be something we can all feel. Bespeak. Be easy, be greasy, be golden, be unique, be tech, be smart, be resilient, be complete. Be strong, be powerful, be black, be proud, be quiet, nah, be loud. Be now, be bold, be new, be old, be young, be fast, be loud. But be first and not last. Be the word, be the fight, be the air, be the light, be the earth, the moon, and the stars, be the shine and the grind, be the bronze, silver, and the platinum, win it all and be the gold. Be seen, be preferred, be deserved, be heard, be here, be for us, be you and I will be me, but be love, be peace, be honor, be happy, and be all that you can be, but be. Speak. That is John Slaughter. You are listening to Voices on the Edge. That is Poetic Justice Style. Hey, you know what? It is Thursday morning, 9 o'clock on this dial. It is KBOO Radio. Hey, you're going to get it. Poetic Justice Style with John Slaughter. I'm going to be here next Thursday. We are going to have a bevy of individuals talking here in the building, calling in. Hey, make sure you call in. Hey, there's more shows coming up. Make sure you're still staying tuned to KBOO. It is John Slaughter, Poetic Justice, Voices from the Edge. I will see you next Thursday. Hey, thank you so much for listening. Have a beautiful day. Hey, stay cool from that sun and that smog. I'll see you next week. Arrah.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Good morning, it's 9:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, and she brings you the news you're not supposed to know.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, you're just listening to, in my opinion, some excellent radio from John Slaughter, and I haven't said, but I found out that the reason you're listening to John for a few months instead of Joanne is that Joanne has stepped down because she is running for city council against Dan Saltzman. How about that? So look that up. Decide what you're going to do. It's August 10th, and I have a number of topics to bring up. Of course, the big topics today are the raid on Paul Manafort's home by the FBI, looking for Trump materials, and the threatened war with North Korea. And I'll be getting around to North Korea in a few minutes, maybe about 20 minutes. And I have a few other items to bring up because other things are happening in the world. So I want to start with, to be different, I'll use Russia Today to report on the Manafort situation. They write, FBI agents seized documents and other materials related to the special counsel's probe of an alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The quote is, FBI agents executed a search warrant at one of Mr. Manafort's residences. Mr. Manafort has consistently cooperated with law enforcement and other serious inquiries and did so on this occasion as well, end quote. That's from Manafort's spokesman, Jason Maloney. Pardon me, skipping ahead. Manafort, a longtime Washington lobbyist and political consultant, worked for Donald Trump's presidential campaign from March to August 2016, first working on mustering party delegates for the Republican convention, then becoming campaign chair in June. In that capacity, Manafort was present in the June 2016 meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and the Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya, which she says was misrepresented by the U.S. media. In August, the government of Ukraine accused Manafort of illegally receiving over $12 million in payments from the Party of Regions for the lobbying work he did between 2004 and 2010. Manafort has denied any improper or illegal actions, but resigned from the campaign and was replaced by Breitbart executive Steve Bannon. There's more to that article. You can find it at rt.com. From Oregon Live, Samantha Matsumoto writes, activist Teresa Rayford filed a $500,000 lawsuit Wednesday against the city of Portland for her 2015 arrest during a political demonstration, saying police targeted her for arrest without probable cause. Rayford was arrested on charges of interference with a police officer and disorderly conduct on August 9th, 2015. The interference charge was later dropped. A Portland jury unanimously acquitted her of disorderly conduct in April 2016. And speaking for myself, I remember that snatch, that grab, and it was rather upsetting. But returning to the article in the lawsuit, first reported by Willamette Week, Rayford says police targeted her for arrest because she is a well-known activist against police brutality. Officers forced her into a police car. One told her that, in her experience, quote, 90% of black people are killed by other black people, end quote. And that's what Rayford says in her lawsuit. Rayford was arrested after an event honoring Michael Brown, an unarmed black teen who was fatally shot by police in Ferguson. And there's more on that article at Oregon Live. I want to say this about Oregon Live. I've always hated the Oregonian for their pro-imperialist stance and their pro-corporate stance, and I still do. But they've always had some great journalists on board. And journalism is very important and very necessary. And it's also very necessary, if you'll pardon me just for a moment, to turn down the sound on your computer if you think you're going to go on the air. You'd think I'd learn. Because you never know when those ads are going to pop up. Okay, I'll try and say that again. Basically, I was saying that journalism is very important. I'm glad that there are good journalists at OregonLive.com and at other institutions in town, and these institutions are dwindling. We need to pay attention to that. And I also want to say to those of you on KBOO.FM, this is a great time to tag KBOO for a few dollars, because this is how we do it. We depend on your support, and this is how we do the news you're not supposed to know. This is how we do everything else that we do. We depend on that support more than anything else. And when everything else falls to the wayside, as it occasionally does, y'all are still here. You're still here. So consider, please, if you're not already a member, pull up KBOO.FM and tag us for a few dollars. Now, from a Dan Hanelman email for Copwatch, which he said he had to compose in haste, the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing to replace the Community Oversight Advisory Board is reset for Thursday, August 24th at 2 p.m. That's 3 days after the eclipse, if you're wondering, at which time the council, per their vote yesterday, will also bring back a revised directive requiring that officers be compelled to testify within 48 hours of a deadly force incident. The version of the new 48-hour rule that was posted Monday was altered sometime Tuesday, and he writes, he had to rethink his testimony a little. He included the comment that it feels as if we're on a merry-go-round and the council knows when it's safe to get off, but the community is being tossed off of it bodily. And in parentheses, it says Commissioners Fritz and Udalli actually said they felt that way too. Now, speaking for myself, my personal opinion is that the mayor, the former mayor, and the council are afraid of the police union and would rather dodge this procedure than see it through. And I think that because of a history of avoiding meetings and even going to court to challenge the presiding judge to avoid an essential January meeting over compliance, which did not happen. And over my life, I've certainly seen this sort of dodging before when it comes to confronting police brutality. So returning to the email from Dan Handelman, in short, today's vote forces the PPB, the Portland Police Bureau, to abandon the advised directive on deadly force that would have delayed compelled testimony until after the grand jury. It orders the city to work with the Department of Justice on fixing up the policy that the mayor proposed last week. It removes the requirement for the city attorney to ask if a new policy is lawful, because, as she revealed toward the end of the hearing, you can't do that with a policy that is already in place, only with one you are considering implementing. There's a paragraph, he writes, in today's, meaning yesterday's resolution, that asserts there should be a loophole for the mayor or chief or city attorney to delay compelling officer testimony. We testify that the only excuse should be if an officer is incapacitated. Commissioner Fish and Mayor Wheeler claim that the idea is only to delay compelling testimony in a, quote, bad shooting, end quote. There was no time to retort that all shootings are bad, but seriously, if they believe it is legal to compel in an administrative investigation that is walled off from the criminal investigation, they don't need that caveat. That's a situation where you would want to compel the officer to talk sooner, don't you think? He writes, so the record is still open on the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing until the 24th. A new draft should be out next week, and we should see also see the new draft shooting policy next week. And he also, Dan also writes about the new Portland police chief, and I'll skip that part for now, but there is the new Portland police chief, and her name is Chief Danielle Outlaw. And Dan writes, yes, that's her name. And she is from Oakland, and the only thing I know, speaking for myself, about her is that apparently Reverend Bethel thinks well of her, at least in some way. So that's hopeful, at least that much, because, hey, that's Reverend Bethel we're talking about. And changing topics now, speaking Tuesday, this is from Radio Havana, Cuba, speaking Tuesday at the 6th extraordinary meeting of the Political Council of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our Americas. Minister Rodriguez demanded that all those interfering in Venezuela's internal affairs take their hands off Venezuela. He added that those trying to bring about regime change in the South American nation are driven by cynicism and hypocrisy. The top Cuban diplomat underscored Cuba's strong rejection of the aggressive, violent stance assumed by U.S. imperialism and its lackeys, the regional oligarchies, against Venezuela and regional integration mechanisms. He pointed to the principles and values contained in the proclamation of Latin America and the Caribbean as a zone of peace and stressed that the fight for Venezuela is a fight for the entire region and the world. He also congratulated the Bolivarian people for their victory last July 30th, when 8 million Venezuelans went to the polls to vote for the Constituent Assembly. He called the July 30th election a lesson in democracy. Again, speaking for myself and again repeating myself, what's going on now is very much reflected by what happened in April 2002. So I urge you to go to YouTube, put in the word Venezuela, and then put in "the revolution will not be televised," and you'll be in for a shock, and you'll find out the manner in which the U.S. likes to meddle with political affairs, likes to side with the richest 1/20th of the population in Venezuela, and destabilize things. And that's what's going on now. Also from Radio Havana, the White House is reportedly considering an unprecedented plan to privatize the war in Afghanistan at the urging of Eric Prince, founder of the now renamed private mercenary firm Blackwater. Prince told USA Today the plan would include sending 5,500 private mercenaries to Afghanistan to advise the Afghan army. It would also include deploying a private air force with at least 90 aircraft to carry out the bombing campaign against, quote, Taliban insurgents, end quote. Prince says the plan would cost $10 billion a year of taxpayer money, which would presumably be funneled directly to private mercenary firms. Each soldier of fortune would reportedly be paid between $500 and $600 a day. The Trump administration is divided over the plan, with Trump's chief strategist Steve Bannon supporting it and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, both former military generals, opposing the plan. And speaking for myself, it should be noted that the U.S. already maintains a mercenary occupation force in the so-called Baghdad embassy walled zone. And, they get paid a tremendous amount. And it is an occupation, and the war is still going on. It's just done by mercenaries, so Obama could say that he had pulled out the troops. Handy, huh? Now, changing topics again. By the way, it's 9:14 Pacific time. You're listening to KBOO. This is Press Watch. My name is Teresa Mitchell. The BBC says China has successfully sent hack-proof messages from a satellite to Earth for the first time. The Messias satellite beamed messages to two mountaintop receiving stations 645 kilometers and 1,200 kilometers away. The message was protected by exploiting quantum physics, which says any attempt to eavesdrop on it would make detectable changes. Using satellites avoids some limitations that ground-based systems introduce into quantum communication. Complicated optics on the Chinese satellite protect the messages with entangled photons, subatomic particles of light, manipulated so that some of their key properties are dependent on each other. Pardon me. The curious laws of the quantum realm dictate that any attempt to measure these key properties irrevocably changes them. By encoding a key to encrypt data using entangled photons, it becomes possible to send messages confident that they have reached a recipient free of interference. Ground-based encryption systems that use entangled photons have been available for years, they write. However, the maximum distance over which messages can be sent securely is about 200 kilometers. Now, speaking for myself, the reason I'm relating this is because the short-term profit greed of the U.S. corporate masters is so overwhelming that even the sacred war industry now suffers and is behind the times, and China is doing this instead of the U.S. and Britain, as its global competition pulls ahead in communication technology. Just a few years ago, U.S. newspapers printed scoffing rejections of the possibility of quantum entanglement technology, saying that Heisenberg uncertainty made it impossible. Note, too, that for years, even as the U.S. demonizes Russia, only Russian rocketry has maintained a human-capable launch system. The U.S. is no longer the top technology nation, and that's because the U.S. is the top corporate bootlicker. So the great bloody empire begins to totter, and maybe that's a good thing if you take the thousand-year stance. When I look at the BBC article, what I just read from them, saying ground-based encryption systems that use entangled photons have been available for years, that's it's a pretty heavy dodge for them to phrase it that way. Hasn't been available to the U.S. in terms of actually functioning systems for years because they won't pay for basic research. There's plenty of research being done in the United States about how to make a better profit off the latest missiles and aircraft, but that ain't basic research, and it's basic research that came up with the quantum entanglement communication system. And this will continue because of the nature of imperialism, the nature of the kleptocracy, the order of thieves that rules this nation. Fine, whatever. So, turning to South China Morning Press. It was 10 years ago on Wednesday that BNP Paribas, a French bank, prevented investors from accessing funds exposed to U.S. subprime mortgages, citing, quote, a complete evaporation of liquidity, end quote. For many, this is one of the triggers for the credit crunch, which led to the most severe financial crisis in history. Much has transpired since the outbreak of the Great Recession, and I just want to turn away from that text for a moment and say, here again we see how things are phrased. It's the most severe financial crisis in history. Well, we don't call it the Great Re-Depression. Oh, no. We don't call it the Greater Depression. It certainly is. And for the millions of people who have suffered and been deprived because of this contraction of credit, it is worse than the Great Depression. Oh, no. We have to call it the Great Recession so that you can say, oh, I'm lucky that I live in these times and I don't really have to do anything about the banking system. But returning to the article by Nicholas Spiro, financial institutions have been fined more than $150 billion in the U.S. in order to settle allegations that they misled buyers of securities backed by mortgages. Again, speaking for myself, $150 billion, we're talking about $1 trillion. and losses. Anyway, markets have been flooded, they write, with liquidity as leading central banks embarked on aggressive programs of quantitative easing aimed at kickstarting crisis-stricken economies. Again, a translation. In other words, giving money to banks is the program. Returning to the article, perhaps most importantly, a fierce backlash against globalization and political elites led to last year's decision by Britain to vote to leave the European Union, followed by Donald Trump's upset victory in the U.S. presidential election. It was 10 years ago on Wednesday that BNP Paribas prevented investors from accessing funds exposed to U.S. subprime mortgages. Yet one of the most troubling aftereffects of the credit crunch is the glaring disconnect between the crisis-scarred economies and buoyant markets, the very same decoupling that laid the foundations for the credit crunch. Advanced economies are still struggling to recover from the Great Recession. While the U.S. returned to its pre-crisis level as early as 2010, the U.K. took another 4 years to surpass the peak it hit in the opening quarter of 2008. In the Eurozone, economic output only exceeded its pre-crisis level in the first quarter of last year, 6 years after the bailout of Greece's economy triggered Europe's sovereign debt crisis. Skipping ahead, Italy, Europe's third largest economy and the country most likely to trigger the next crisis in the Eurozone, is not even close to surpassing its pre-crisis high. According to the International Monetary Fund, Italy is poorer, as measured by real disposable income per head, than when it joined the euro in 1999. Just as worryingly, public indebtedness across the eurozone has increased significantly, partly due to the costs of Europe government and bank bailouts. Public debt, as a share of gross domestic product in the bloc, has shot up from 65%. Has shot up from 65% just before the crisis to nearly 90% last year, according to Europe's Statistic Bureau. One-third of the members of the eurozone now have public debt levels close to or above 100% of the GDP, including Spain, the supposed poster child of the eurozone's recovery. Now, speaking for myself, this article is about Europe, but all of this is reflected in U.S. finances, and it describes the same sort of thing. So you can find that at scmp.com. Now, there are two wars threatening to break out right now. You've heard about one of them. You possibly have not heard about the problems between China and India. So I want to pass on a little bit of the reporting internationally on that. The first is from NDTV. That's an Indian source. Rejecting India's suggestion for a simultaneous withdrawal of troops to end the standoff at Doklam, China, on Tuesday. China on Tuesday upped the ante, wondering what New Delhi would do if it enters Kalapani region and Uttarakhand or Kashmir. India and China have been locked in a face-off in the Doklam area of the Sikkim sector for 50 days after Indian troops stopped the Chinese army from illegally constructing a road in the disputed area. China claimed it was constructing the road within their territory and has been demanding an immediate pullout of the Indian troops from the disputed plateau. Bhutan says Doklam belongs to it, and the Chinese have illegally entered Bhutanese territory. Even if there is only one Indian soldier, even for a day, it is still a violation of our sovereignty and territorial integrity. That's a quote from the Deputy Director General of the Boundary and Ocean Affairs of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And that minister was briefing an Indian media delegation whose visit was sponsored by the state-run All China Journalists Association on China's stand on the Doklam standoff. The quote is, "It's impossible to have a dialogue with India at this time. Our people will think our government is incompetent," end quote. Well, here's more of the quote. "Until the Indian side withdraws from the Chinese territory, there will be no substantive talks between us," end quote. She reiterated Beijing's stand that the only way to end the present crisis on the border was withdrawal of Indian troops from Doklam. Now, speaking for myself, the latest news seems to be that all but about 50 troops have been pulled back by India from the immediate area. But China is not satisfied at this point. Asked whether China was getting ready for a war with India, this is returning to the article, Ms. Wang said, "I can only say that for the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese government, we have the determination. So if the Indian side decides to go down the wrong path or still have illusions about this incident, then we have the right to use any act that is in line with the international law to protect our rights," end quote. Now I want to talk about what is wrong with that statement from India. In the first place, India's sovereignty over Bhutan is fictional. It all has to do with some British people said long ago and far away, and Bhutan has been described by India as its protectorate, but Bhutan has not described itself in that way. And it is not at all clear that Bhutan is not separate from India. And it's probably one of those things that should be put to the test, maybe not today. But India, on the other hand, China, on the other hand, has claimed the territory in that region for quite some time. And let me explain what I'm talking about. If you look at the map of India, you see the V-shaped subcontinent. And if you're looking at a map oriented to the north, as most of them all, then you will see that India is connected to its northwestern territories, whose name escaped me right now. Let's see, I think Assam is one of them. So that you could not take a direct line. I'm trying to pull up a map on my now silenced computer. You could not take a direct line from Calcutta to those territories without cutting through Bangladesh. And there's just this little neck, this little area that goes up to a plateau in the mountains next. So Nepal is abutting it on one side, Bhutan on the other, and Tibet, now claimed by China since they invaded Tibet, is to the north on top of the map. And it's that little neck that is the problem here. And really, if you look at it, you can see that the Indians are saying, well, you can't encroach on this because we'll be cut off from our own territory. And that's what it really comes down to. And China is saying, this has always been ours. And the stuff that you say that you own Bhutan is BS, which it is. Now, from livemint.com, here's another take on it. Dateline New Delhi, the countdown to a clash between the Indian and Chinese forces has begun. And that was warned by a China Daily editorial yesterday. With the Doklam standoff entering into its seventh week, the editorial said the window for a peaceful solution is closing for India, and New Delhi should come to its senses while it has time. Meanwhile, a Chinese defense ministry official yesterday questioned how India would feel if Chinese soldiers entered its territory at Uttarakhand or Kashmir. India's only way to avoid conflict is to withdraw its troops from the Doklam region, which is a Chinese territory, says the editorial. Terming the current situation in Doklam as different from previous standoffs, it further warned that India should not harbor any illusions and underestimate the resolve of the People's Liberation Army. Yada, yada. This is all rhetoric. And what this gets down to is you need to understand that both countries have brought tanks and artilleries and troops together at this flashpoint. And China is saying that over this next week, push is going to come to shove. And India is saying, no way, you can't do it. And there's no diplomatic solution at this point. In terms of remake of the 1962 border war, it doesn't look good, not at all. So that's the first war that is being threatened. And of course, you've heard about North Korea. And before I read anything about North Korea, I want to say about the idea that has been apparently been accepted. If I look on Twitter, it has been accepted by some sectors of U.S. society. The idea that some North Korean nuclear missile is going to come raining down on your head is complete bunk. They ain't got them. I can say this with great certainty because the people who really look at this, who really track the missiles, know that whereas North Korea, which is a very poor nation, has managed to put together some impressive missiles and which have an intercontinental ballistic missile range, it's very unlikely that they have a miniaturized warhead that could survive the reentry process even with a proper heat-hardened, heat-adjusted nose cone reentry vehicle, and they don't have the reentry vehicle. And the reason I can say that is, the militaries of the world have watched these missiles go up, watched them go down, and they go snap, crackle, pop on the way down. They do not have a reentry vehicle. You cannot set off a nuclear weapon without its rather sophisticated, timed, shaped explosives going off in exact sequence. Ain't happening. Now, that's not to say that Trump couldn't provoke things so badly that nuclear war wouldn't happen. in which case there's more bunk being put out saying what to do in case of a nuclear war. There is nothing you could do in the case of an actual launch of real intercontinental ballistic missiles, which could really come from China and or from Russia if things ever went to that point. There's no place to hide. I think that any rational person would prefer to be instantly incinerated than to hide well enough to die over the next week from radiation. That's gross. You don't want to go that way. So this game cannot be played. So now, turning to South China Morning Post again, that's SEMP.com if you want to follow those. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis has warned North Korean leader Kim Jong-un that his government's military provocations may lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people if the threats continue. Quote, Kim Jong-un should take heed of the United Nations Security Council's unified voice and statements from governments the world over who agree the DPRK poses a threat to global security and stability, end quote. That's Mattis speaking in a Defense Department announcement. He also said the DPRK must choose to stop isolating itself and stand down its pursuit of nuclear weapons. While our State Department is making every effort to resolve this global threat through diplomatic means, It's hard to quote U.S. State Department BS sometimes. But returning to the U.S. State Department BS coming through the mouth of Jim Mattis, it must be noted that our combined allied militaries now possess the most precise, rehearsed, and robust defensive and offensive capabilities on Earth, end quote. The time is 9:30. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm giving you this information in the hopes that you will absolutely oppose this and all the imperial wars. Before I go further, let me give you the phone number to call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. That's 503 area code, 231-8187. What's my opinion on all this? My prognostication, that is, I think this is more bluff, more bluster. The things, as which I will detail in a moment, that the North Koreans say are even more blustery than ever, and I don't believe them. The things that Donald Trump has said are very blustery, and since when do we believe him? So hopefully nothing is going to happen. But there's a lot to be said, isn't there? Number to call, 503-231-8187. Some people are already showing up at the White House to protest war, to protest this threatened outbreak of war with North Korea. So many reasons. One of the first reasons is, even if everything went perfectly smoothly with Pentagon plans, it would kill Koreans at a huge rate. Somewhere between 60,000 and a million people are going to die immediately. They're all Koreans, and how is it that it's okay to kill them? How is that okay? Because the alternative is doing what we've always done with other nuclear-armed states, even after making a huge hullabaloo about the facts that they were nuclear-armed. They were nuclear-armed in response to us, if anyone seems to remember. We came up with nuclear weapons. Ta-da! We made them. Look at that. Now we own the world, and some parts of the world said, well, we can make those too. And so for all these years since the Second World War, we have lived without having a nuclear war because it would be a stupid idea. And so that's called mutual assured destruction. Now, North Korea by itself cannot offer mutual assured destruction, no matter how much they bluster about that, for the reasons I was speaking before. They might could set off a nuke. They might even could get one over here somehow. They'd have to trick out their their vehicles to get it this far, because their stuff just doesn't, they don't have the range. And as I said, their ICBMs don't work. And I was going to say something else, but I forgot. Because, hey, war, who needs it? And the first caller is available. Number to call, once again, 503-231-8187. Hello, caller, you're on the air. Hi, Ken, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. This is about Venezuela. It seems to me, and I'd like your reaction to this idea, that what's going on in Venezuela today is exactly what happened in Chile in 73. And then Guatemala, when they got rid of our Benz. So if you want to comment on that, I'd be glad to hear what you had to say. And And that's all I have to say. Take the response off the air.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. Yeah, there are similarities there. In 73, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger was famously quoted. Actually, this is a secret for quite a while, and he was quoted in the 80s. I said that something to the effect of, we cannot allow a people to go socialist due to the irresponsibility of their own people. In other words, the hell with democracy, we'll tell them what to think. And the U.S. was very much in favor of, in support of, provided covert support to, and logistical support to the coup by General Augusto Pinochet, which resulted in an utterly fascist regime, which pleased the Chicago School of Economics. They came down there and started running things the way that they always wanted to, because they're a bunch of damned fascists. And they rounded up people in a coliseum and killed them and tortured them and just had a grand old time. And Chile was fascist for decades. And they did the same thing to Jacobo Arbenz. That government was overthrown in a coup. This has been done across the world in so many places. It's been done to Iran. And that's how we had the Shah. They had the Shah, and they had the Slovak torture police. That's what the U.S. prefers, and that's why we call it imperialism. And that's what's going on in Venezuela, yes. There are differences, of course. It's a different flavor, but in the essential qualities, it's much the same thing. Something like 5% of the Venezuelan population has financial and political and social and even family ties to the United States, and really would prefer that the United States ran the place. Can't stand it that the Bolivarian Revolution has been so strong for so long, starting with Hugo Chavez. And that's what's going down. Yeah, it's another coup. And you are being presented, per usual, by complete crap on the media, which leads you to believe that the people are bravely standing up to an illegitimate imposed government. That's not true. They just had elections. Their elections, in terms of how honest they are, have been checked out by none other than Jimmy Carter, who found them to be pretty darn good elections. And I would say that the United States population doesn't have much to say, morally speaking, in terms of the solidness of elections in other countries at this point. So there you have it, everything I have to say about Venezuela on the point. Number to call with your comments and questions. I want to talk about this threatened war with Korea and other topics that I've brought up. The number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Turning to SCMP, Kim Jong-un, this is a quote, should take heed. Oh, I already read that part. I want to read you the quotes from Donald Trump from a couple days ago, which I'm sorry to read, but you need to know this. He tweeted, my first order as president was to renovate and modernize our nuclear industry, My first order as president, he tweeted, was to renovate and modernize our nuclear arsenal. It is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power, but there will never be a time that we are not the most powerful nation in the world. Exclamation point. And then this provoked a comment from North Korean General Kim Rok-yeom, describing President Donald Trump, quote, sound dialogue is not possible with such a guy bereft of reason, and only absolute force can work on him, end quote. They write, the combative tone from Washington has some analysts concerned that the door to diplomatic solution is closing as the exchange of threats continues throughout the week. China has called repeatedly for the U.S. and North Korea to negotiate directly since the escalation of tensions around the Korean Peninsula last year. And they have a quote from Robert Daly, who's the director of the Irony Here, Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson, more irony, International Center for Scholars, in exchange with the South China Morning Post. We're in it thick, aren't we? Okay, now I'm getting to the quote. Here's the quote. Prior American presidents have shared Donald Trump's frustrations with North Korea, but none of them promised Armageddon if Pyongyang continued to issue the kinds of threats it has made on a monthly basis for decades. Now, speaking for myself, when they say Pyongyang has made this sort of threat for decades, that's exactly accurate. KCNA, their propaganda agency, says the most outrageous things and has for a long, long time. Speaking for myself, they perceive that they need to punch up and to threaten and to say what they can do and what they maybe can do and maybe what they can't do, but you don't really know over there, do you? So we're going to say we can do this. And this is something that they've been up to for a long time, since they existed. And so you have to take what they have said this week, the last couple of days, in that context, and that should give you some relief from anxiety, I should hope. But there's a reason why I'm devoting the second half of the show to this. Number to call, 503-231-8187. The combative tone from Washington has some analysts concerned. I already read that part. Prior American presidents have shared his frustrations with North Korea. I'm sorry. I need to keep my notes a little better organized today. Here's what I meant to read. China tries to present itself as the reasonable adult in a room of squabbling children. Beijing will therefore continue to respond to the heated rhetoric from Washington and Pyongyang by calling for a calm, and calm is indeed in short supply. That's a quote from the Kissinger Institute director, Robert Daly. Pyongyang appeared to have no immediate intention of calming things down. On Thursday, the official KCNA news service quoted General Kim Yak-gwam lambasting President Trump, quote, sound dialogue is not possible. And I already gave you that quote. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, speaking to reporters while en route from Asia to Washington, sought to play down Trump's fire and fury comment. And speaking for myself, this is a thing that's happened a number of times now, isn't it? There's a complete child in office, and the grown-ups have to explain that you don't really have to take what he says seriously. And what Tillerson said was, quote, nothing that I have seen and nothing that I know of would indicate that the situation has dramatically changed in the last 24 hours. Americans should sleep well at night, end quote. And, of course, that reminds me of George Bush saying, go shopping. Okay, the number to call, 503-231-8187. And I have caller Kim. Go ahead.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
It's always a pleasure to listen to your program.
Thank you.
It's not inconceivable that North Korea would be able to place a nuclear or perhaps even thermonuclear device in orbit so that it could be detonated over the United States to produce an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse effect, in which case that reference to attacking Guam would be something of a feint. Your comments, please.
Well, I think that's a really good point. They could do that, couldn't they? Because if they have at least one miniaturized nuke of whatever size, if they can launch it up, as I was saying, their reentry vehicles are crap and won't survive. But yeah, they could do the EMP thing, which would immediately get them obliterated with nuclear weapons. I mean, why would they think that mutual assured destruction would not apply to them? I can't imagine them doing that.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
Please carry on with your wonderful efforts.
Thanks.
Good day.
Well, that's the question. I mean, it's rhetoric, isn't it? The capabilities are finally coming to match the rhetoric. And so I may have a quote of this in my text here a little further down, but I'll just jump to it. Basically, what they threatened this week is they said, now look here, we can send our missiles to within 40 kilometers, which is what, something like 30 miles away from Guam. and they're talking about launching rockets to do that. And they might do it next week, and they're giving a deadline for that. And this, as I said, this is part of their usual bluster, I think. And the way they said it was, we could submit that plan to our glorious leader. And well, the thing is, you know, this came from their glorious leader, so they're just posing with that. So here's hoping they're posing for the whole thing, because whereas they may have the precision to land the things 40 miles from Guam and do a big scare, it wouldn't work in that sense, because once you launch the things, we're talking about the things going so far and so far up and taking such an arc that a 1% difference in throttle pressure, a 1% difference in throttle pressure would put the things directly on the territory of Guam. And so no military, you know, I hate imperialism, and I really don't like taking the perspective of the imperial military, but it's necessary in this case. Imagine you're on Guam, and you're in the military, and your radar says those missiles are going up. You really don't know if they're going to hit you or not. There's absolutely, you cannot, because throttle is variable, you cannot calculate that they are actually going to hit where they say they're going to hit. So if they launch those missiles towards Guam, well, before they get to the ballistic stage, while they're still in the boost stage, there will be a counter launch against North Korea, and the war is on, because there isn't any slight or a little bit of war against North Korea. And this is the problem with all the other plans, like, oh, we'll decapitate them. No, you won't. You shoot anything into North Korea and the war is on. Everyone knows that, really. I guess that sort of thing is just said to make the American public feel better. Oh, we could go in there and take them out. Yeah, sure you could. That's just bunk. Absolutely you cannot. And if you're thinking of the raid on the compound of Osama bin Laden, that was a stunt in the first place. That wasn't really Osama bin Laden. Oh, conspiracy theory. I bet you don't like that. It's true, though. I mean, Osama bin Laden died years before that. He did not have a fat nose. He had white hair, not dark hair. His ears were different. That was not Osama bin Laden. And that compound that they sneaked up on with their special helicopter, which they crashed, wasn't North Korea. Didn't have radar searching for them. I won't say it was easy for those guys to sneak in there, armed to the teeth with ballistic vests on them and the latest in weaponry and this and that and the other and all the training. I won't say that they didn't have some courage to do that, but the raid was a stunt, whether those soldiers knew it or not. And America does not have the capacity to decapitate North Korea. Ain't going to happen. And any attempt will result in that immediate war, which I've spoken about so many times, that all North Korea has to do and what they will do is pull the lanyard on some long-range artillery and blow people up in South Korea. So the number to call with your comments and questions, I'm hoping this isn't making you oppose war with North Korea and oppose any further bellicose rhetoric from the idiot in the White House. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, returning to the article, Tillerson and Trump spoke for an hour while the Secretary of State was in transit. North Korea came under increasing pressure from its neighbors, Russia and China, over the weekend when they voted in favor of the United Nations Security Council resolution put forward by the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. aimed at further isolating Pyongyang. Now, speaking for myself, these sanctions are intended to hurt and will hurt to some extent. They'll be dodged to some extent. North Korea is very poor and can't afford them. Over the long term, if war doesn't break out from the sanctions, which is starting to look like it might, it would degrade their capacity to buy more rocket material. Because a lot of the stuff that they're using is bought. They're buying sophisticated systems and assembling them rather than coming up with everything indigenously. So it could have an effect. Mostly it just makes them madder than hell. They have had famines. Their people could well die of starvation from sanctions. The usual, if there is a war planned, the usual way of doing it, as we see with the case of Iraq, is to starve them for a long period of time and then invade with massive force after getting them to scrap all of their offensive weaponry. North Korea has learned from this and will not turn over its nukes and its missiles as Saddam Hussein did, because they saw what happened to Saddam Hussein, who used to be a great friend of the United States. So did the Assad regime. And the imperial parasite that takes our taxes, has sent people to be tortured by the Assad regime. That's how friendly we were with them. Isn't it wonderful being part of such a moral nation? Number to call, 503-231-8187. The time is 9:48. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and we have some other programs coming up that you will want to know about. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein at 11. On Between the Covers, author Jamie Harrison talks about her novel, The Widow Nash, an old Western mixed with a Victorian classic. Excuse me, a Victorian classic, and a fierce feminist twist, and 11:30 Words and Pictures brings you conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Topic right now is North Korea and U.S. imperialism. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. A photo distributed by North Korea's official news agency last month shows an intercontinental ballistic missile being launched at an undisclosed place in North Korea. The latest resolution goes beyond a prohibition on exports by sanctioning North Korea's state-owned foreign trade bank, which is identified as the country's primary foreign exchange bank. The resolution prohibits the formation of any new joint ventures between North Korea and other nations and bans additional investment in existing ones. Almost two-thirds of Americans cannot find North Korea on a map. Citing joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises that include live-fire drills as a threat, North Korea's government has for more than a decade maintained its right to conduct missile and nuclear detonation tests and rejected the legality of U.N. Security Council sanctions against it. In May, North Korean Deputy Permanent Representative to the U.N., Kim In-rong, slammed Secretary General Antonio Guterres for not responding to his request to convene an international forum of legal experts to discuss the legal justification for U.N. sanctions. The Security Council has issued 8 resolutions since 2006. After 6 nation talks involving North Korea, China, the U.S., Japan, South Korea, and Russia broke down. The U.S. Defense Department characterizes the joint exercises, which have been conducted regularly for 40 years, as defensive in nature. The exercises are designed to increase readiness to defend South Korea, to protect the region, and to maintain stability on the Korean Peninsula. And those exercises that I just mentioned, pardon me, I was skipping ahead a bit there. The big problem is that these exercises are not defensive in nature. They practice nuclear weaponry. And they're intended to frighten North Korea, and they do. And they cheapen life in North Korea by forcing them to direct so much of their income, their gross domestic product, to whatever weaponry they can find, afford, or cobble up. And the deal is through China and has stood for years and has been available, could happen right now in terms of a negotiation, is to simply stop. The U.S. can just stop spending its billions of dollars to threaten North Korea. Stop the exercise. Don't do the exercise. That's all it requires. It's just don't do it. And North Korea is willing to negotiate the cessation of testing of nuclear weaponry and missiles. Easy as that. So what we're really talking about here, you know, as offensive as North Korea can seem to be, the real problem here is the United States. And the real driver of war versus North Korea is the United States. And you may have noticed in the last couple of weeks articles appearing saying that there are trillions of dollars worth of mineral assets in North Korea. And isn't that what it's really all about? I was told when I was a kid in school that the war in Vietnam, which was ongoing until I was an upperclassman in high school, was about defending freedom. And of course, what it was really about was cornering the market on oil, tin, rubber, rice, and cheap labor in Vietnam, and a certain amount of posturing towards the Soviet Union. And so what do we have here with this war in Korea? Much of the same. From The Guardian. By the way, the number to call, 503-231-8187. North Korea has defied threats of fire and fury from Donald Trump, deriding his warning as a load of nonsense and announcing a detailed plan to launch missiles aimed at the waters off the coast of the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. A statement issued to General Kim Rak-gyeom, the head of the country's strategic forces, declared, quote, sound dialogue is not possible with such a guy bereft of reason and only absolute force can work on him, end quote. The general outlined a plan to carry out a demonstration launch of 4 intermediate-range missiles that would fly over Japan, which is a problem in itself, and then land in the sea around Guam, enveloping the island. Quote, the Hwasong-12 rockets to be launched by the Korean People's Army will cross the sky above Shimane, Hiroshima, and Koichi prefectures of Japan. They will fly for 3,300 and change miles, kilometers for 1,065 seconds and hit the waters 30 to 40 kilometers away from Guam, end quote. What could go wrong? And as I mentioned before, anything could, and of course the U.S. military would not tolerate that for a second. They couldn't afford to militarily. That is not in any way tolerable. The war would begin when the missiles were launched. So what are they thinking? I think they're thinking bluster, and I think that they're not going to do it, but it's not clear at this point. And so that is the basis of the problem. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. The statement said that the plan for this show of force would be ready by the middle of this month. And, of course, you'll note that it's already the 10th. And then await orders from the Commander-in-Chief Kim Jong-un. The statement was clearly designed as a show of bravado, they write, calling the Trump administration's bluff after the president's threat, and a statement from the Defense Secretary James Mattis, both stressing the overwhelming power of the U.S. military. Trump said on Wednesday, North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met by fire and fury like the world has never seen. The response from Pyongyang was its most public and detailed threat to date, and evidently meant to goad the U.S. president. Trump had let out a load of nonsense, they said, quote, about fire and fury failing to grasp the ongoing grave situation. This is extremely getting on the nerves of the infuriated Hwasong artillerymen of the Korean People's Army, end quote. The U.S. has a naval base in Guam, and the island is home to Anderson Air Base, which has six B-1B heavy bombers. According to NBC News, the non-nuclear bombers That's what they wrote. According to NBC, the non-nuclear bombers have made 11 practice sorties since May in readiness for a potential strike on North Korea. The remote island is home to 162,000 people. Non-nuclear bombers? Well, I guess I'll depart from that. The B-1B bomber was developed as an attempt to have the speed of the old B-58 Hustler with the range of the B-52 bomber. And like the B-52, you can put a rotating rack in that bomb bay, and that makes it a non-nuclear bomber. You can take that rack out and put it in a big old nuclear bomb. So I don't know why The Guardian is falling for this crap. Oh, I see. Excuse me. It's NBC News is giving you the idea that it's a non-nuclear bomber. That's really not true. And of course, the North Koreans understand this, that when a B-1B heavy bomber goes zipping past our territory, as has happened several times, it's a gesture of a nuclear strike. And more specifically, it's a gesture of a nuclear strike in which the U.S. is saying, okay, we won't risk launching a general war with ICBMs. We won't set off the radar of Russia and China. We'll just bomb you with this aircraft. And that's the real meaning. They know it. You should know it. And that's how bad the threats have been. And all North Korea is asking for really is just stop that kind of stuff. Stop that. Stop threatening. Stop threatening nuclear war. And we will negotiate. And the U.S. pretends that, oh, we just can't afford to do that. And these are just defensive exercises. Just a lie. Simply a lie. And it's aimed more at you than anyone else. Other people, other countries understand well enough what this is about, especially if they're on the target end. Returning to the Guardian article, South Korea's military said today that North Korea's statements were a challenge against Seoul and the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Joint Chiefs of Staff spokesman Ro Jae-chan told a media briefing that South Korea was prepared to act immediately against any North Korean provocation. Japan's chief government spokesman said the country would never tolerate this. North Korea's actions are obviously provocative to the region as well as to the security of the international community. And that's a quote of Yoshihide Suga of Japan. The announcement on the North Korean state news service KCNA came at the end of 2 days of brinksmanship, which began with a leak of U.S. intelligence report that Pyongyang had developed a nuclear warhead small enough to put on a missile. This was followed by Trump's warning of fire and fury. On Wednesday, the U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis said a North Korean attack would risk, quote, the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. On Thursday, Trump's deputy assistant Sebastian Gorka declined to tone down the rhetoric, warning Pyongyang, quote, do not challenge the United States because you will pay a cost if you do so, end quote. Asked if the threat of a strike rather than an actual attack were enough to provoke a response, Gorka told the BBC, quote, if you threaten a nation, then what should you expect? A stiffly worded letter to be sent by courier? Is that what the UK would do if a nation threatened a nuclear-tipped missile launched against any of the UK's territories, end quote. Damian Green, the UK's first Secretary of State, urged the Trump administration to use UN processes to resolve the crisis. A quote of Green is, it's obviously in all our interest to make sure that nothing escalates. We are very strongly in support of the UN process, which has and continues to put pressure on North Korea to stop acting in an irresponsible way, end quote. So I would like to suggest that you call your U.S. senators here in Oregon. That would be Merkley and Wyden. If you look them up on the web, you'll find their phone numbers easily enough, and tell them your opinion of whether you support or don't support a war with North Korea. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, it'll be Between the Covers. We're going out to you at 90.7 FM in Cascadia and other frequencies in the greater Cascadia area. Stay tuned to KBOO.FM, and it is via the World Wide Web on KBOO.FM that we go out to all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock, and coming up next is Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne in Portland. Guerrillas of Desire argues that the left is wrong. The strategies are often based on the assumption that working and poor people are unorganized or simply uninterested in building a new world. Again, that's Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's Books, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.